Yeah, that's working.
Yeah. Many of your parts, you played Oriental and Chinese. Did you ever feel that you were portraying Chinese or the Orientals in a nasty way, or in a role, in a stereotyped way that you didn't think was really fair to the Chinese?
It's very strange, but for some reason, you know, you've heard about typecasting. It seems that while I always played, of course, Oriental parts, I was always typecast as a good guy. I think that I've only played about two or at the most three in all these years since 1934 or 5. Oriental parts where you might say, well, he's nasty, you know. He's not such a good image for the Chinese, for the Orientals. I think one was a communist officer I played in a picture at Columbia, in which I was in charge of a concentration camp, and I used to treat the prisoners rather roughly. And then I think I played a Japanese spy, I think in a picture Across the Pacific, I think it was, with Humphrey Bogart. And then what the other one was, I don't remember. But that's about it, because everything that I've done in the way of Oriental characters, I've always been what I would call good guys, and I would either be a businessman, or I would be a diplomat, or a doctor, or an average Joe, you know. I've been very lucky that way. And I know during the war, for instance, when I was at Metro doing the Gillespies, many studios wanted me to be loaned out, you know, to have MGM lend me out to play villain roles, Japanese villains especially. And the studio would never let me out. He says, no, he says, we have him here for a specific purpose in the Dr. Gillespie pictures, and that we don't want to ruin the image, you know, so forth. So I didn't play many of those fat villain parts that were to be played during the war, Japanese villains and whatever, Oriental villains, so on. So that's it.
How do you think Chinese were portrayed in general? Not specifically your roles, but...
Well, in general, of course, you see, from the early days, they had these cliches, you know. The Chinese were objects of mystery and evil and all that, shadows and hatchets flying around and all that sort of thing. Well, of course, that lasted only to a certain point, and then suddenly it began to shift. The image of the Chinese or the Orientals as a whole improved better. The writers were writing better characters. The producers didn't want to use those old stereotypes. Now, I'm speaking out of actual experience now of what producers have told me, you know, during conversations. So he says, now, look, says, we don't want to get these old cardboard characters in there. He says, we want to write parts for human beings, regardless of the Chinese, the other thing, and so on. So it was a very, very enlightened attitude. And I think one of the first breakthroughs came with the Charlie Chan pictures, because for the first time, an Oriental was the hero. Chan was absolutely... unbeatable. Nobody outfoxed him. He was smarter than anybody, always solved the case. And he did so with tremendous dignity and courage and graciousness and wisdom. He let drop all these proverbs and so on and so forth. And the public was just delighted with it, with that character. And as I said, it became, of course, one of the biggest money-making and longest-running series of all time in Hollywood here. And then when I stepped into the series as the completely Americanized Chinese boy, it was a delightful contrast in that I was full of energy and always jumping at conclusions. Come on, Pop, let's go, and all that. And Father's always holding me down, and so on. And I'd come in with a clue, and he says, so sorry, but number one son, like last rose of summer, bloom too late, case solved, you know, and so forth, see? And so it was a delightful contrast, and it became, of course, a very, very popular team. And it helped the Chan stories a good deal. So that's it. And now today, of course, I know that the like in Roots, for instance, where they tried to make an honest portrayal you see, of the Chinese as they lived over here and of the vicissitudes that they had to go through and so forth. And, of course, historically now I'm speaking, with this rapprochement between the United States and China, there is going to be, I think, an even greater improvement in the type of characters that the Orientals will be playing from now on.
Did anybody ever protest?
Oh, yes, there have been protests, yeah. Chinese groups or individuals have protested and sometimes been very vocal about it. And the studios have listened. I mean, they've been always attentive, lent an attentive ear. But you see, these things are slow to change. And until some impetus comes along, which forces, you know, a quick change or a modification, an alteration or amelioration of the situation, you're not going to have it. Now, we do have it today in the form, as I just said, of the new, this rapprochement between China and the United States. Now, the writers are going to be writing different things. They see the Chinese now in a different light, you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the character's going to be more true to life, and the situations are going to be more realistic. And I think that it won't happen. We won't be deluged with great parts overnight, but I think that fine parts, and maybe occasionally a great one, is going to come along now. It's much more possible now than it was, say, 15, 20 years ago. So I'm very optimistic about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many Chinese actors and actresses were there before the war?
Oh, heavens. You can almost safely say that there was only a handful. There was Richard Liu, myself, Victor Sen Young, Benson Fong, actually as Chinese actors. And then, of course, we have our fellow Orientals, now Philip Ahn, who was Korean. And we had Teru Shimada, who was Japanese. And, of course, we had Nancy Kwan, who was rated as a star. She was Chinese. And, of course, in the old days, Anna Mae Wong. But then two or three others, maybe, you know, who had any stature at all here in Hollywood. But since the war, and this new generation has come along, and there's a different attitude now towards the Oriental in motion pictures, we have now, I would say, almost a plentiful supply of acting talent, both actresses and actors, and in a wider range, age bracket now than we also used to have.
Mm. Do you think Orientals were treated fairly and equally, you know, same as...
Well, yes, I think they were. You see, it's a question of the regulations under which you work. See, we all belong to the Screen Actors Guild. And so, of course, the guild is without a doubt, I think, the greatest union in the world.
Before the... When did the guild...
Well, the guild came way back in the 30s.
30s.
Yeah. You see, so it covered the whole period that we're speaking of, you see. The period when there were just a handful of Orientals to now. And today we have a plentiful supply of talented and capable Japanese, Chinese, both women, both men, and so forth. And we have Koreans. And I regret to say that I don't think we have too many Filipinos. We have some... I think you would almost count them on the fingers of one hand. You know? And that's about it. Three or four good Korean performers and so on. But whether they're Korean, Japanese, Chinese, or Filipino, or whatnot, the fact still remains that the Oriental talent pool is much larger now than it was. So, and I think that I forget, with the Japanese actors, an excellent actor, my good friend Jimmy Shigeta, he's very good, played my son, many things, or nephew or something like that. So,
do you think the increase in Oriental actors and actresses has to do with a change of attitude about acting at all?
Well, no, not necessarily. I think that as the new generations come along, there's just more of them. And they all picked professions, and since there are more of them have gone into the acting profession. Because when I started in back in the 30s, middle 30s, early 30s, good heavens, there weren't too many Orientals around. That is, of the younger generation. They've all come up. I mean, your generation has come up since then. You know.
How did your family feel about your acting career, your mother?
Oh, well, they were very, very proud. My mother was so proud of me. Good Lord, she... My sister used to be so embarrassed because whenever we had a new Chan picture, naturally, mother had to go see it. And so the family would go, and it was all my sister could do to keep mother quiet, you know, during when I was up there. She'd turn and say to her, the next person sitting next to her, you know, she didn't even know, that's my son, you know. So they were all very, very glad of it. Well, my sister came down here for the first time when I was with the Chans. The studio wanted to put her under contract because she's very attractive. She still is. And so I said, oh, no, no. I said, one actor in the family's enough. You go back there, back to your job, and be happy. Stay happy. Stay out of this crazy business.
Did you ever regret not pursuing a career in art?
Well, in a sense, I've never given it up. I don't produce as much as I used to. But you see, today especially, I've had a new impetus, been given a new impetus in that interest and study because of the archaeological excavations that they have over there in China today. All the discoveries of new treasures from those old tombs and so forth. This is a fantastic chapter in archaeology. And of course I'm absolutely, I'm fascinated by it. And I was fortunate enough to see those big traveling exhibits that came over from the mainland China, which were held here and in San Francisco. And just unbelievable, the treasures.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I haven't given it up, and I still give impromptu lectures and so forth on Chinese art and philosophy. But I used to do it regularly each season, but now I just, once in a long while, some friend will inveigle me to talk about it at a little dinner party or something like that. But we used to lecture before clubs and at the museum and culture societies and so on and so forth.
Mm. So because of your involvement in the movie industry, does that mean that most of your friends and associations were with non-Chinese?
Yes, for a long time. Of course, I've always had my own family here. And I've always had Chinese friends, you know, like, you know, Gilbert Leung and Tyrus Wong. But see, there again, it was strictly an art group, you see. Because
mm-hmm.
Gilbert was a very good sculptor and architect, and Tyrus is a painter and so on, and I was an artist and actor and so on. So it was a sort of a narrow, you know, narrowed down to people who were just interested in the arts, and we're all about the same age and all that. So I've always had, you know, Chinese friends that way.
Did you go to Chinatown much?
Yeah, oh yes, we used to go down there all the time. I used to go down and see Gilbert's wife, Florence. His father was F. Suyon, you know, the pioneer dealer in Chinese art and objects of art. Marvelous man. And he used to show me a lot of his things that he would put on display and so on. And Gilbert studied at Schoenaard, and I studied at Schoenaard for a while. Tyrus studied at Otis, which was 2-3 blocks away from the Schoenaard, down the Westlake area. And then I've always, not a month went by, but while I was down Chinatown on weekends, dinner, you know, with friends and so forth. So I never lost any contact with the Chinese group here, but my actual intimate friends were just the few that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How about involvement in family associations?
No, that there? I've never been. I'm not involved in any organizations of any sort, American or Chinese, except that I belong to the guild, you know, and all that, because I belong to the guild because I'm an actor, and I belong to AFTRA because I'm an actor. But so I don't. I used to, years ago, I belonged to the California Art Club, but I don't even belong to that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Who do you consider to be some of the more prominent families, Chinese families in Los Angeles?
You know, I couldn't tell you. All I know is that the Leung family, you know, Gilbert Leung, so and his brothers and sisters, we knew very well, and the Suyon, and that's about it, those two families. That's about it.
So you never, did you live in the Hollywood area while you were
working? Yeah, I always lived in the Hollywood area. Uh-huh. And my brother also lived in the Hollywood area. Mm-hmm. And we're still in the Hollywood area. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you ever feel a need to live amongst Chinese or closer to Chinese?
No. My brother lived here also for a while, and then he was down, then he moved permanently to Long Beach. So never felt any real necessity to live amongst Chinese any more than I live amongst, you know, the Americans. I mean, I'm a more or less of a loner to a great extent, and my interests are not popular interests, and so consequently, the only people I have anything much to do with outside of my, it's the work and all that sort of thing, are just people who are interested in the arts or acting or music or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about,
to get back to originally, so how were the Chinese treated in pictures? I was going to say that the guild, see, has certain regulations, and the studios and producers all observe these regulations, so whether you're Chinese or this, that, or the other thing, those working conditions apply to you, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we all know that if you're bigger you are, and reputation, and so forth, and all that, the more leverage you have, you know, and so forth. But no, there have been no, that I know of, or if there have been discrimination or untoward acts or things like that, racist motivated or anything like that, they've been speedily corrected, because the guild gets right after them, if not the Chinese group themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What
was an average salary for an actor?
I don't know, because I've never worked I never worked for what they call scaled. I don't even know what that is, you know. See, with me, everything is a deal or a bargain, and it's always above scale, you know. And it depends on the budget, depends on how much they really want you and so forth. You make your separate deals with the picture, for each picture. So I really don't know. I was talking to somebody the other day about what is the actor's minimum now, and he didn't know. I think it's something like a speaking part, you know. I think the scale now is what, 250, 280, I don't know what it is a day. But all those things, then you begin to bargain, if you have the leverage to bargain, you see. If you don't have, then you just simply work for scale until the time comes when you do have enough leverage. And that's what all actors work for, is to get above that scale thing and to, you know, and get what they call their salary, their salary, with quotes around it. Because for one it might be, say, $750 a day, another it might be $1,000 a day, or another it might be $1,500 a day, see, and so forth. And of course, you don't get that every day if you go into a deal that goes over a period of time, because then, say, you get $1,000 a day, which would be, what, $5,000 a week, you see, five working days. What? But if you're going to get, say, a four-week contract or something like that, they'll knock you down from $5,000 maybe to $3,500 a week, you see, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you work longer, you see. Mm-hmm. They say, well, okay, if you work longer, you got to give us a break too. So instead of paying you $5,000 each week, we'll pay you $3,500 each week, see.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, well, all right, I lose the $5,000 straight salary, but since it's going over 4 weeks, I'll, you know, take the deal, you see. So it's always like that, you know. And of course, the big stars, good heavens, I mean, they if they get participation, you know, they say, okay, we'll work for a nominal salary, see, and then the rest is participation. So much, 5%, whatever it may be, 10%, I don't know. above, you know, of the gross or of the net or however they set it up. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then if he has money in the picture himself, naturally he becomes part owner, and if there are profits, why, he gets tremendous profits,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So it's like Bill Holden. He worked for a nominal salary, as I understand it, but he took a percentage, a chance, a percentage on the gross of the picture, the bridge over the River Kwai. And of course, it made millions. He made millions.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Did you still support your family?
Oh, no,
you were acting?
Well, they're all grown up.
Your mother?
No, my mother passed on years ago.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. I did support my family because, you know, my father died when I was very young, 19. So in the old Chinese system, naturally the oldest son became the head of the family. And I supported the family, and the kids were all great. As soon as they were able, they all pitched in, went to work, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Put everything into a common pool. We paid for a house, and I sent my brother through university, and my sister became very, very, fine, very, very expert as a buyer for cosmetics, and my other brother became a buyer for a drugstore chain. Then later on, he became a dentist, and my brother, who's down here with me, he became a printer when he came down here and printed the Hollywood Reporter for about 20 years. Then he went into social work, and they just retired it. And my sister has given up her Revlon work and all that, but she married a man who's Kay, who was a very, very fine businessman, automobile dealerships. And so everybody's done well in the mainstream, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all done it with a little help. I've helped them, they've helped me, what the heck, you know. And everybody's pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. So it was really very, very nice.
Do you think that the Chinese in general were affected by the Depression?
Well, I don't know. Gene, I really can't answer that. I know that I would say it, of course, that the Chinese are, let us say, without fear of contradiction, that they are generally more thrifty, that they're more industrious, and that they have a built-in sense of survival. Given an even chance at all, they're going to survive and survive very well, and so on. So all I know is from my part, being at that time connected with Fox Theaters, we sat in the offices there, and we used to kind of pat ourselves on the back. We said, look, the country's in a depression. We said, our motion picture business is making more money than ever because people needed cheap entertainment, you see, to take their minds off the problems of the depression. So we were thriving. So that's the only answer I can give. I know of no instance that came to my attention where groups of Chinese or anything had to go through any particular hardship during the Depression.
Since you became such a well-known actor, did any Chinese, for example, the ones who worked as extras or whatever, ever come up to you and see if you could help them and give them a break?
Oh, yes. I used to help a lot of them. I mean, I'd make suggestions and all that sort of thing and so forth. And they were very appreciative, and I was glad to do it, you know, so on. But, so that's it. I mean, I do that to any fellow actor, you know, whether he's Chinese or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate it when my fellow actors did the same to me.
Where do you think most Chinese men met their wives? I mean, do they, before the war, did most Chinese men go back to China to marry?
Before the war, I would say isolated cases. But by that time, there were enough Chinese in this country, male and female, let us say, so that they didn't have to do that anymore. I know in the old days, it was very customary to do. But no, that's all broken.
Was there much, did you feel much, discrimination as far as you know, before the war, do you think, as far as being Chinese, anti-Chinese sentiment?
Well, no, there was no such, there wasn't much of that. On the other hand, let's not say that there was any visible evidence of extremely warm feeling or anything like that, but I don't think so. Then especially since China became an ally, you know, of this country and all that, and Roosevelt came out and said, heretofore we have not permitted Orientals, you know, to be naturalized and so on, and he was thinking particularly of the Chinese. He said, let us now just wipe that thing off the books and redress an old error that we've committed, and now Orientals can become naturalized citizens and so forth. So I was the only one of children in the family born in China. So consequently, I was not a citizen, you see. Mm-hmm. So when Roosevelt made that announcement, I went down and signed up to be naturalized. And I would have been the first Chinese in this country to be a naturalized citizen, had it not been that I was in a picture at that time with Wally Beery, and I had to work on the day that I was to appear down at the court. And a Chinese New York doctor beat me out of it. He became number one. And Walter Winchell, you know, who was very big then, carried it on his broadcast. He said, Key Luke, Charlie Chaff, number one son, just missed being number one Chinese naturalized U.S. citizen. He had to shoot, be on the set, and couldn't get away, and so consequently so-and-so in New York.
How about interracial marriage? What were feelings before the war on that?
Well, before the war, now for instance, now in California, Orientals and Caucasians could not intermarry, and so forth. But since the war, of course, all that was put aside. In my family, for instance, let's see now, my brother, Edwin, has two daughters and a son. The son, Alan, is married to a German-Canadian girl, and he's teaching up there in Vancouver, and she is also going to teach when she gets her degree in German. And so that's an interracial marriage. And then one of slightly lesser degree is that his daughter, eldest daughter, married a Japanese. And then his youngest daughter married a Caucasian, a very brilliant electronics wizard. And they're nothing but making money with inventions and so on. So that's another. In that one family, there wasn't one what you call natural marriage, that is a Chinese with a Chinese. So then,
about before the war, about how many cases of interracial marriage do you think?
Oh,
there were
just a
handful.
There were a few. Yeah, there were a few. But now, and just as you see black and white marriages now, even, and that of course was unheard of, you know, at one time. And so, then in my case, of course, I married a French and Irish wife, and then. My brother, Jean, son and daughter. The daughter married a Japanese, and his son is also married a Japanese. So, let me see now. Yeah, that's it. So our family, my brothers and sisters, liberally sprinkled with interracial marriages, you know.
Do you think American-born Chinese also place importance and stress on having sons, like the old?
Oh, they may. I don't know. I don't think that as a matter of principle. I think that I don't care what, it's a boy or a girl. But maybe I'd rather have a boy, you know, something like. But in the old days, it was imperative, you know, that you have a son. And boy, you better have a son to carry on the family name and all that, and to put the incense on the altars and all that sort of thing after you're gone. But today, I think, especially here in America, I think that's broken down.
Mm-hmm. How about the generation that had, like yours, and it would lived in the States for a long time? Did many Chinese of this generation feel it was important for their kids to go to Chinese school?
From what I can gather, I think that, now I'm talking now to parents that are more or less my generation or just one removed from me, which makes us still pretty close as far as ideology, ideas, and all that sort of thing are concerned. And most of them feel it would be good to have them study Chinese, but then they sort of add, but you know, that's kind of difficult. They, you know, busy with what they're doing, and they're preoccupied with the things that concern them in this environment, and so on and so forth. Because I know that I, for instance, I say to my my nephew, brother's son in Vancouver, I said, you're teaching Spanish, you've taught English, and I said, why in the hell don't you learn Mandarin, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, I'll get around to it someday, you know, and so on and so forth.
Did many Chinese people ultimately hope to return to China before the war?
Oh yes, that was before. I don't think that obtains anymore. I think now, especially since the new rapprochement, I find that a lot of them say, well, now I got a chance to go back and see the old village, you know, or something like that. But it's purely a sentimental thing.
How many do you think actually did?
Well, in my Mandarin class, for instance, my gosh, there were, let me see.
I mean, how many do you think actually returned to live? You know, those who came to
the
States,
days.
Right?
A good many of them, a very large percentage, because a lot of them died over here, you know, and so forth. But a good many of them went back. That was the prevailing conviction, the prevailing pattern. You came here to make your money and save it and so on, and then you went back, you see. That was the thing. Of course, now, with all these Chinese Americans and so on, they know nothing at all about China or anything like that, the homeland. But with my generation and those that are still close to me, it has become a sentimental thing. Because in this Mandarin class that I'm in, six or seven of them have just come back. And they're all in their 50s and 60s, you know, so and rooted over here, their business and their children and everything else, rooted. But since they had the opportunity and the means, they went back to look at the old ancestral village. The interesting story, Tyrus Wong went back,
mm-hmm.
and he went to the old ancestral village, and so help me, he said, I'm walking down the street, and there comes my sister walking towards me in the opposite direction. I recognized her, and she recognized me after all these years. You know. So that was rather amazing. So then they've gone, they've seen it, and of course, under the new conditions, they've seen the physical lot of the people improved over what it used to be, and so on, and then they come back here, and they've done it. They've been back to the homeland, and so
mm-hmm.
on. But to now pack up and go back to stay, I don't think that enters their minds.
Mm-hmm. And what about people who came over here on paper names, Jimian? What percentage of the Chinese do you think actually had paper names?
Oh. You see, this is the mountain of gold, and the people over there would give everything to get over here. So consequently, you know that there were also a lot of people over here who were willing to help them get in, fair means or foul, with a little money exchange,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a lot of money exchange. So that's it. And so how many of them are there here? I don't know, but there are, I would say, without fear of contradiction, quite a few. But I think that's getting to be less and less now, because you don't have to do that anymore. You can come in. There's a liberalized quota, and you can even become, naturalized and so forth. So there's no need for that anymore. But I know that in the old days, my father's day and so forth, oh yes, that was a thriving business.
Would you say that was common enough so that about half or over half the Chinese who were here had paper names?
Well, I don't know exactly, but I would say that under the conditions and with the attraction that this country had as a land of opportunity and gold and all that, that I would say, but it could be. Mm. It just could be. Because you also have to remember that all that imported labor that came over for the railroads and for the mines and for the agriculture and all that sort of thing, you see. Now, those people came in under bona fide means. I mean, they were probably hired out, signed up for so many years of work and so forth through brokers, you know, both brokers here and brokers over there, and they'd come over and they'd work and make their money and so forth and so on and go back. Or they died over here in the process. Or some of them may decide just to stay. So mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I know that, especially since, you know, those exclusion laws were put in. See, mm-hmm. that was, I think, when the falsification of papers, I think that was when it was most flourishing. But I don't think anything that exists to any degree now, any considerable at all, because it's all opened up.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel embarrassed to be Chinese, or do you know of anybody who ever felt embarrassed to be Chinese
States? No, I don't know. See, what helped me was I was always aware of China's cultural achievements, you know, and I always had, I knew enough of history, Western and Chinese, to have a sense of comparison and a sort of a perspective, so that, as I said in this meeting of the minds, I was chiding these friends. I said, "Here we were." I said, "China, a long history, thousands of years of civilization, of scholarship, of poetry, of art, of philosophy, of administration, and so forth." And this is your country with barely 200 years of history, and yet you insisted on treating us as though we were barbarians, you know? And so I always had that historical awareness, and then of course study of Chinese art and so forth, which of course is one of the greatest art manifestations in the history of mankind, and all that gave me certain things to hold by, you know, so that I never had that feeling of being culturally deprived or culturally inferior or second rate because my skin was different or things like that. The only time whenever I felt a little bit saddened by the whole mess is because my skin was a little different, I couldn't get certain jobs that I wanted to get. Like I get out of high school and in the summer I wanted to make some money delivering telegrams for Western Union. Though since I was Chinese, I couldn't get a job, you know, that sort of thing. But as far as any personal manifestation of racism or anything like that directed against me, no, I never had any of that. Because in the first place, when I was in school, I was always the guy that generally got the best grades, you know, and everybody, you know, have a sort of little thing. And then I was good enough athletically so that nobody could push me around physically, you see. So I was pretty lucky that way. And
have you ever heard Chinese compared with the Jews as far as success?
Well, yes, I think that I have heard that they both have a strong family system, and they both have a long and honorable history reaching way back and so forth, and that there's certain the personal characteristics of industry, of an awareness, of a worldliness, a practical sense in dealing with life and so on and so forth. Yes, I've heard them compared. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that the Chinese...
Jews themselves admit it. Yeah. I've heard Jews tell me that themselves.
You heard Chinese make that comparison too?
Yes, I've heard Chinese make that comparison. Mm-hmm. But I've heard more Jews make that comparison than Chinese.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How do you think that the Chinese have done in general? Do you think they've done better or worse, or just about the same as the general population in L.A., of L.A.?
Well, I don't know. That's a hard question to answer. But I do know this, from what I have seen and by experience, in consideration of the population quota at the time I was growing up and the population quota now, and in consideration of the number of Chinese then that, after schooling, let us say, entered the mainstream, and compared to the ones that do now, there's no comparison at all. Because granted that there weren't so many in those days, and that there are more today, still, see, the atmosphere today is so much more favorable. You see, the doors are open if you have the ability. The law of the land says, you know, equal employment, no discrimination because of a man's background, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All those things have helped. But I do think that basically the determining factor is that these Chinese that move into the mainstream as doctors, lawyers, architects, name them, you know, scientists, name them, name the field and they're there, are there because of their intrinsic ability to begin with, and also because the opportunity is here now. So I think that by and large, I think that also includes the Japanese, too. I think that the Chinese and Japanese, what, ethical minorities, the two of them, or as an Oriental group, the two, I think have advanced more, percentage-wise, into the mainstream than other, say, Oriental groups.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now, with the Koreans burgeoning here, in the local economy and so forth, but that in a sense, is not an exact measure of what they really have been able to achieve, because they came in here under certain, in a sense, favorable conditions made favorable for them. The Korean War and all that, and the immigration over to here in this country, and certain, what shall I say, regulations or certain things that were made easier for them by the government and all that have helped them to develop a thriving community here almost overnight, you know, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And they were given certain advantages, which is all right. I mean, I'm not criticizing it, I'm just saying. But I think in the normal course of events that have taken place over the past few decades, I think the Chinese and the Japanese have done percentage-wise very well.
What kinds of jobs were most Chinese doing before the war?
Well, they were doing more services, labor. You know, of course, the restaurants, the laundries, the businesses, and stores, and all that sort of thing. but then their children, on the other hand, you see, have gone into the mainstream by way of the different professions, sciences and arts and so on and so forth. So, of course, a lot of them do still remain the business people and so on. But I think it's a very, very unusual and very gratifying thing to see. Because, as I said, from the days when I couldn't get a job as a Western Union messenger to the what?
What did they tell you? What reason did they give you for?
They simply said the. They just can't use you, that's all, because you're Chinese.
Did you protest, or did you make a...
No, I resented it, and so on, but I didn't... You see, I wasn't the type that would let a thing like that just rankle me, and so on and so forth. I just, all right, I didn't, that door didn't open, I'll try another one, see? So the first thing I knew, I had this, I didn't have to go around getting too many refusals, because the next time I started out, I had my artwork. And from that, that was instantaneous acceptance. I mean, instantaneous acceptance. And I started to sell things, and I started to do artwork and so on and so forth. So who the hell needs a Middle Western Union job?
When was that? What year?
Oh, that was back in the 1920s, 20, 21, 22, you know, around that time. I was then about, what, 17, 18, you know, and so forth by the age.
Was it pretty difficult in general for Chinese to get jobs outside of, you know, with non-Chinese and
yes,
not
it
in
was.
Chinese
it was because it,